podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles from Washington, D.C., where we all hope doing what is right the first time is everyone's top priority. This is Software Quality Today, presented by Procellarex, a podcast about the trends and challenges of software quality testing and computerized system validation, and the people who are leading the way. Hear interviews with special guests and news from customers and vendors. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo, and welcome to today's episode. Welcome to Software Quality Today. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo. On March 2nd, I had the honor and privilege to sit down with Dr. Sue Black, OBE, at the Chief's flagship clubhouse in New York City. It was a live audience recording with Sue, who also happens to be my cousin. Dr. Sue Black, OBE, is the Professor of Computer Science and Technology and Director of Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion at the Computer Science Department in Durham University in the UK. She leads the pioneering Tech Up Women program, retraining women from underserved communities into technology careers. Sue is an internationally known, multi-award-winning technology evangelist, inspiring speaker, and media figure who is well known for championing women in computing, promoting women in STEM, and running the successful campaign to save Bletchley Park in 2011. Sue set up the UK's first online network for women in computing, BCS Women, in 1998, and in 2012, a social enterprise, Tech Moms, to help disadvantaged moms retrain, and subsequently published the experience in her book, Saving Bletchley Park, How Social Media Saved the Home of the World War II Codebreakers. Sue has written many articles evangelizing about technology, over 40 academic computer science papers, and is currently working on a coding book to be published by Penguin. Board trustee for Comic Relief and a digital ambassador for Global Partnership for Education, Sue has spent much of her career helping people and organizations to realize the amazing opportunities and potential that technology can bring, from refugee moms on welfare through to the UK Prime Minister. In 2016, she was awarded the OBE by King Charles for service to technology. Enjoy and listen to her inspiring journey and all the insights that she has for us today. All right, well, welcome to Software Quality Today. We are recording today a special episode from Chief's flagship clubhouse in Flatiron District in New York City. I'm super excited because today we are celebrating and kicking off Women's Future Month, which is the new Chief rebranding of Women's History Month. So what awesome timing to have Dr. Sue Black here in New York City with me today. So welcome, Sue.
Hi, Dori. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's just such a pleasure to be here today with you.
So this has been an interesting relationship that we've had.
Absolutely.
So let's start there before we kind of go into all of your history and who you are and why I thought it was really important to bring you to this podcast today. So you want to start us off? How did we meet?
Sure. I mean,
it's weird.
I can hardly believe it, but did you check how long ago it was? When did it happen?
2018, 2017.
Oh, really?
Maybe
feels
a
like longer.
Bit, maybe 2016.
Everything goes a bit crazy in my head now after lockdown. Yeah. I've kind of like lost time or gained time or something.
That's
true. It's very confusing. So we met on 23andMe.
It's not like we met on Tinder or something, but we met on 23andMe,
yeah,
which is equally as digitally fun a place, yeah, to meet people.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think so. Back then I didn't have so many matches. Like, there's so many more people on 23andMe now than there were whenever it was that we met. But so from all of the, you know, you get your list of highest matches, and so you were the highest match that I didn't know, basically, on my 23andMe. And I was like, who is this woman? And so I messaged
and I
you.
I happened to be in the US.
So I was in London in the UK. You're in the US. And I didn't know who you were. So I thought, well, I'll message, I think, my top three people or something that I didn't know. And you were one of those. And we ended up like kind of having a back and forth about who we are and how we might be connected. And unfortunately, we still don't know how we're connected. We haven't managed to find that out. And we don't know exactly what kind of cousins we are.
Right.
Like, maybe, well, I just checked it just now and it's saying fourth cousins.
Right. Which, so, I think back then we were like third,
yeah,
or second,
yeah,
or third,
yeah,
or something like
it
that.
It seemed a lot closer. But in my head, You are my cousin. And that's all that matters.
That's what we talk about. Yeah. And so we met, and then I was able to be over in London, and we met up there, and then you came to the US.
Yeah.
And you were doing some talk here.
Yeah.
And we met up in DC.
In DC.
At the
embassy. With, yeah, that was crazy.
Where you met my child at that time, which was like, I can't believe it, how small they were. And a teenager. So. And then
crazy.
Subsequent, which is even stranger, is that I had met you before I met my birth mother. And I met my birth mother through
23andMe. Yeah. So I've kind of been partly on that journey with you as well, which has been wonderful.
Yeah. Coincidentally, we also happen to be in this weird space of computer science, which I never thought I'd be in because I was a chemist. But
yeah, that's crazy too, right? Because you have a podcast about software quality. Mm-hmm. What's my PhD in? Software quality. It's just like...
And that's really
you
rare.
You couldn't make it up. Yeah. You just couldn't make it up. Yeah, there's not that many PhDs in that area, I don't
know. So why don't you tell everyone all of those doctorates that you have, and you happen to be an OBE. And so tell everyone your journey and how you got to be who you are today, because it's pretty
cool.
That's
a long story. I don't know if we can fit all of that
into... You can shorten a little bit.
Okay, well, where do I start? I guess I come from a background where both my parents were nurses, and I had a brother and sister that are 5 years younger than me, twins. And I was living just a regular life until my mum died when I was 12. And my dad remarried the next year, so possibly too quickly and possibly to the wrong person, just a personal opinion. And my life went from like living in a functional family to living in a dysfunctional family. All sorts of horrible things happened. I left home as soon as I could. So that was when I was 16. I lived with my friend's family for a year. Then I moved. I was living out in Essex, like 50 miles from London. Moved to London, did various jobs, and ended up getting married at 20, had my first daughter at 21. Then I thought, well, I'll have another baby, then go back to work. The other baby turned out to be twin boys. So at 23, I had three kids under 2.5. And then, unfortunately, after that, my marriage broke down. So we had to run away to a women's refuge one morning on the other side of London. We lived there for 6 months, and then got a council flat. Kind of started life again, I guess. And I hadn't expected to be in that situation. So to start with, I wasn't quite sure what to do, but then I thought, okay, I need to get a job. I need to earn some money to look after my kids. But then realized I'd left school at 16. I didn't have many qualifications. I probably would have been working in a supermarket on the checkout, something like that. And when I looked at how much I would earn doing that, it wasn't enough to pay for childcare, let alone everything else. So I couldn't actually go back to work. So I thought, okay, well, I didn't want to leave school when I was 16. I just had to because of my circumstances. So I thought, why don't I try and go back into education? If I can get a degree, I'll be able to earn more money, and then I will be able to pay for everything for the kids. So that's what I did, really. I went along to college, did like a maths course at night school. That enabled me to go to university, studied computer science, did my degree. And then in the last year of my degree, my dissertation supervisor said to me, what do you think about doing a PhD? So I said, oh, I'd love to do a PhD. Well, I didn't tell him that I didn't know what a PhD was. But then I did go and look it up in the library. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I would like to do a PhD. And I would have a lot more money from doing that than when I was an undergraduate student. So did a PhD, then became an academic, kind of rose through the ranks over several years, became head of department in 2006. So I was head of department for 4 years, then stepped out of academia for 8 years, and then came back in 4 years ago. And now I'm professor of computer science and technology evangelist at Durham University in the UK, which is the third oldest university in the UK after Oxford and Cambridge.
Right. And you are...
Did I answer your questions? I don't even know.
That's even more. And you're deputy vice president now, is that correct?
Of the British Computer Society?
Yeah.
So in a couple of weeks' time, I become deputy president of the British Computer Society, which is about 70,000 members in the UK. It's like the professional society for people working in tech.
Yeah.
And in a year's time, I'll become the president, unless I do something terribly wrong, which hopefully I won't.
I don't think so.
We shall see.
So it's amazing because I think there's a lot of similarities. And I've been interviewing a lot of women over this last year in different podcasts as well. And all of us have these journeys that we go on. And it's very common to have, we never thought we'd end up where we are.
Right.
We never thought we'd had to work as hard as we had to do in order to get to where we are.
Right.
And they're really inspiring stories, right? But they're not necessarily celebrated all the time.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I think as girls in general, we're brought up to make sure everyone else is okay and then think about ourselves last. And mm-hmm. so, and to not show off. I can remember being, you know, yeah. I was a very shy kid, but I remember being told not to show off. I don't know what someone right. thought I was showing off about.
Right.
And that's how we're brought up. So I think that affects the way you see yourself and what you're able to do, what you're capable of doing, what is okay for you to do as you get older and you move into the workplace. And then in the workplace, you're supposed to put yourself forward for things, but you've always been told not to do that.
Right.
And I think there's loads of things like imposter syndrome, I think, come from that.
Right.
It's like the mismatch between right. how you've been brought up and then what you're expected right. to do.
And having to do something in advance of maybe the competence that you have in those particular skills just yet, right? Yeah. Because we haven't yet gotten to needing to do it or needing to learn it or whatever those things are, but we have to actually do in advance of where we're at in order to feel confident enough yeah. to do it at next step role.
Yeah,
there's that. I have a lot of women that say the same sort of thing, like, well, I'm not ready for that. Do we think that men are actually ready for that?
Yeah.
It's not that they don't have that narrative that we have.
Absolutely. I think both of the narratives can be toxic, really.
Right.
You know, it's toxic for men to have the narrative they have, which is they've got to compete with each other all the time. They've always got to be the best because, of course, everyone can't be the best.
Right.
Right. So yeah. that causes issues as well. You know, and boys are brought up, again, this is in general, but not mm-hmm. to cry and right. all of that kind of stuff. So then when they're in the workplace again and they need to, you know, respond emotionally to things that are going on, sometimes they can't because they've had to bury all of that stuff,
yeah.
you know, and that leads to, you know, like mental health problems. Well, I think for all of us, right?
Yeah. It's, I'm excited about the embrace equity is the theme of International Women's Day and Month this year. And I think that we don't talk about that enough on both sides of the table. Some of the other podcast guests that I've been talking about is on, what do we need to do? What's the change in narrative of the male side of the conversation as well? Yeah. And it's equally important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us about your OBE and how that came to be and all the work in Bletchley Park that you've done and what that means to to London and UK. I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah. yeah, it is. Yeah. So, you know, it's crazy. Even like, how often do I talk about this? And I'm still like, oh, I feel a bit embarrassed, but you know, so I didn't really know what Bletchley Park was the first time I went there. So I went there in 2003, and the only thing I knew was that the codebreakers worked there during the Second World War. And in my head, it was like 50 old blokes wearing tweed jackets. I don't know why. and that's what I kind of thought I knew about it. And the first time I went there, I found out that actually it wasn't 50 old blokes. It was 10,000 people working at Bletchley Park, code breaking during the war, and about 8,000 of them were women. And so there wasn't anything online and not much at Bletchley Park itself about the women's contribution, but they were 80% of the people that worked there. And so I found that out. And that time I went away and thought, I need to do something to raise the profile of the women that worked at Bletchley Park. And I went away and got some funding to run an oral history project. So to interview the women that worked there and capture their memories of what they did there, to capture that for posterity. And then at the launch of that, found out that Bletchley Park might have to close because they were short of funding. And it's like a 26-acre site north of London. And then did a tour of the site at a reception at Bletchley Park and found out that the work that was done there was said to have shortened World War II by 2 years. And at that time, 11 million people a year were dying. So potentially the work that was done there saved 22 million lives. And I just thought, this place can't close. I've got to do something about it. So basically, I ran a campaign to save it for 3 years. I managed to get us in the press in the UK and like on the BBC front page of the BBC website, on BBC News, which actually went round the sort of BBC worldwide. So that went worldwide. So I managed to get lots of publicity really quickly, but nothing actually really happened after that. And it wasn't really till, this is probably going to be unpopular now, but till I started using Twitter that actually it made a massive difference. You know, it really did, because I was, for the first time, really able to find people that I just couldn't have found before. Because I could just type Codebreaker, you know, like hashtag Codebreaker or Bletchley Park into Twitter and then find anyone in the world that was already tweeting about those things, so already interested. And then kind of like gradually build up sort of critical mass of people that cared about Bletchley Park and get them involved in the campaign. And then in February 2009, I saw Stephen Fry tweeting that he was stuck in a lift with a selfie. And I just thought, Stephen Fry, I know he loves history. I know he loves technology. He must be interested in Bletchley Park. So luckily he was following me on Twitter. So I sent him several direct messages. And he responded the next day and tweeted a link to my blog that was kind of like the campaign blog. And I'd been getting about 50 hits a day on my blog, thinking, whoa, 50 hits a day, that's great. And then one tweet from Stephen Fry, and I got 8,000 hits that day and became the most retweeted person in the world on Twitter that day. So that was kind of a turning point for the campaign. But it actually took another 2 years until Bletchley Park had enough money that they, you know, they knew that they would be able to stay open. I introduced Google to Bletchley Park and they gave them some funding, and also they got money from the Heritage Lottery Fund in the UK. So they got about £5 or £6 million, and then we knew it was all going to be okay. And then I guess that then led, well, I don't know, because the whole OBE thing is all secret.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. You don't know it's going to happen.
You have no idea, like someone's
nominated you. Yeah, no, you don't know anything about it. So I just got this letter through the post one day, which was just like some sort of printed out. It didn't look fancy or anything, saying you've been nominated for an OBE. Do you, you know, is this your name? Is this your address? Do you accept this award? Please tick the boxes, you know, and send it back. And don't tell anyone, like anyone at all about it. So I kind of like got this. And actually, I think the letter came through the door and I just kind of like stood there like, is this really true? And I just sat down on the floor and started crying because I didn't even really know what an OBE was again, but I knew it was something good, that, you know, that people valued a lot. So I was just utterly amazed because I had no clue that was going to happen. But it just kind of like, it made me feel like I've got to keep it secret, and I'm probably not very good at keeping secrets. And so I took the letter, and I think, you know, I must have showed it to my husband. And then I think I put it out on the side, and then someone must have knocked on the door, and I was like, oh my God, I've got to hide the letter. So I like stuffed it under a pile of papers or magazines or something. And then I completely forgot about it. So I didn't send it back in. So then I got an email about 2 weeks later saying, we sent you this letter, you know, like from the Cabinet Office in London. Did you get it? And I was like, oh my God, yes, I did. Yes, I do accept it. Crazy. And it was for services to technology. So, you know, I don't know exactly how all of that came about, but that was amazing in itself. So that was like in the November. And then there's a list twice a year. So it was the Queen's honours list in 2016. So I think that was the New Year's honours. There's one in June for the Queen's birthday and one in December, the New Year. And so, yeah, so then it was announced. So then it was all over the press. And so that was amazing. And then in May 2017, I guess, I went to Buckingham Palace and Prince Charles, now King Charles, gave me the OBE. And yeah, how crazy is that?
It's awesome. It is. It's amazing. And so valuable, all the grassroots work that you've done in order to do that. And then also to have the surprise of someone out there thought that what you were doing was that special to have that nomination is just really amazing. Awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool. I still can't believe it now. And it's like 7 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. So from that, did Tech Up Women get launched? Is that kind of what drove you to do that new initiative?
So I guess I set up the UK's first online network for women in tech back in 1998 when I realized.
So you were already doing this stuff.
I was doing women in tech stuff from when I realized I was a woman in tech, because before that I hadn't realized. I thought I was in tech, or I was a computer scientist. I hadn't realized I was a woman in tech.
Gotcha.
I guess because my degree There were about 10% women. So it just felt normal. It was about 90% guys, 10% women. Mm-hmm. That was completely normal. Roughly the same, like kind of going into academia, it's probably about 10-15% women. So that's an, you know, was my normal environment. Mm-hmm. And then, well, when I was doing my PhD, my supervisor said, it's not just what you know, it's who you know. Mm-hmm. When you go to conferences, you've got to network with people. And I was very shy and really mm-hmm. didn't want to do that, but I kind of forced myself. And so I was going to computer science conferences and not always having the best time because I hadn't thought about it. But I was, well, the first conference I went to, I thought, okay, I'll set myself the target of talking to one person here that I don't know, because for me that was horrific. And so I chose a guy who gave a great talk. He was very down to earth. I went over and approached him, chatted to him about my research in the break, and that all went well. I was like, oh my God, it worked. But then for the rest of the conference, every time I turned around, he was staring at me, and I got really, really freaked out. Like, did I offend him? Like, what was it? Well, you know, and I think looking back, he just thought, wow, who's that lovely young lady who came to talk to me? But back then I thought, what have I done wrong?
10% of the women in the room.
Yeah, so that really freaked me out. And I tried networking a few other times. And yeah, it didn't work out that well. And then I went to this Women in Science conference in 1998 in Brussels. And I remember walking in thinking, oh God, networking, I've got to do networking again. And then just like walked in, got my badge, went to get a cup of coffee. Went and stood at one of those standing tables. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of other women there. And for the whole 2 days, I didn't have to think once about networking because everyone was talking to everyone the whole time. And it just really helped me to realize that if you're in the majority, life is just easier. Mm-hmm. And you don't always notice that. So that was a great lesson for me. So I came back from that, set up the UK's first online network for women in tech, BCS Women, so British Computer Society Women's Network. Still going strong now, 25 years later, which is amazing.
Wow.
And then, so I've run various different sort of women in tech initiatives over the years. So I set up a social enterprise, Tech Mums, teaching tech skills to mums in disadvantaged areas back in 2012, I think. So that's, you know, run for 10 years now. And more recently, when I started as professor at Durham University, I got some funding with a colleague, Alexandra, there to run a program to retrain women from underserved communities into tech careers. So I've talked to so many senior people in tech companies who want to employ more women over the years at various different events, you know, and quite often they'll say, what's the one thing that we can do to mm-hmm. get more women? And it's kind of like, well, you probably need to do more than one thing.
That's right.
So I've had that conversation so many times. And also I've met so many women that want to work in tech. But just don't know how to get into tech. And so I thought, well, why don't I try and create a program which will take women with potential and train them into specific job roles, working with industry partners who tell us what they want. And so that's basically what the program is. Mm-hmm. The first time we ran, the top four roles that the industry partners wanted were data scientist, software engineer, agile project manager, and business analyst.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran that program with 100 women, our first cohort, and it was highly successful. Nearly everyone got a job after. We finished just before lockdown, which wasn't the best timing, but I think by now practically everyone's got a job, and about 50% got jobs within 6 months in tech. And, you know, they came from all different sorts of backgrounds, like artists, lawyers, mm-hmm. teachers, right. nurses.
So I can imagine that you teach them more than just those computer skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else?
So a lot of it is about building confidence. Mm-hmm. And I hate to call it that, but, you know, I wouldn't call it that with the students that are coming on the program. Because, I think none of us want to be told that we're not confident enough. Yeah. That's horrible. That's like the worst thing you can say. Yeah. Yeah. So we just really focus on making sure everyone has a good time, getting everyone bonding with each other, getting everyone bonding with us. You know, I'll give a talk. Several of us will give talks which kind of show our vulnerability, because I think that helps the women in the room mm-hmm. to feel that they can then be vulnerable. Right. And it's kind of a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of that at the beginning. And we have several residential meetups, but the talk content is practically all online. And the meetups are all about having inspiring speakers, particularly women of colour, because we really try hard to have more than 50% women of colour on the programme so that they can be a majority, which, you know, in the UK, you're not as a woman of colour.
It's the same here.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the numbers are low.
Yeah. So, yeah, so we really focus on that and just really celebrating everyone's successes and, I don't know, trying to make it like this amazing group of women who are going places, and to help everyone to feel that, you know, we've had some really great successes.
And that's wonderful. It's women supporting women. Yeah. It's one of the things that I love about Chief here, is that the amount of support that I get or in the community that I build is what we put into it. So what you're sharing, what I hear, what you're sharing is how much of that passion that you've put into that, and it's given you tenfold and helped and served those that needed it as well.
Absolutely. And it's been wonderful now, because I've been doing stuff for women in tech for like 25 years. And, you know, at the start, I just wanted to connect everyone together. I didn't really know what to do with it. But I've then ended up, you know, I have so many people contacting me, women usually contact me through LinkedIn or I give a talk at a conference and they come up to me after, or email, asking my advice, you know, in various different ways. And it's been so amazing now, particularly over the years, that, you know, I'll get an email from someone saying, oh, do you remember that conversation we had 10 years ago? And you basically, I mean, most of what I do is encourage them to do what they want to do. It's not complicated.
So providing the space in an authentic way of being who you are, and giving that the opportunity for that relationship.
Because I think society doesn't give us that as women. Yeah. So we need it. You know, we really do need it. And it's just amazing to get that feedback time after time of women who've gone off and achieved stuff. And, you know, I might have had a 2-minute conversation with them or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just helped them to get out there and achieve their potential. It's wonderful.
Yeah. The transition to new technology and new skills, I would imagine that some of the program that you've developed now also then has to constantly look towards the future. And what else do they need? What other technical skills do they need? What other networking skills? Other than that, like, what do you see for the future for the program?
Well, I think we'll always be guided by industry. So every time we get some more funding, we will find industry partners that want to work with us, and then we ask them exactly what they need. So we will totally be guided by industry, because I think that's one of the, you know, academic programs, degrees are great, and I'm an academic, so obviously I'm going to think they're great. But at the same time, we need people to have industry relevant skills if they're going to go straight into the workplace. Right. So we will always be guided by what's happening in industry.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I know you talk to some of the big organizations out there, and I work in the life science sector, so I see some of the big ones there, and the future of work is changing so rapidly, and then what the innovation of the products that they're making is changing. And when I interview some new upcoming folk in my specific industry in validation, we don't know yet what that looks like, right? So we're making it up as we go.
Yeah.
And nothing wrong with that. That's also part of being also a scientist, right? Yeah. Like you kind of have to make it up, and you use it until it's not useful anymore. You make up something else, right? But in your partnerships with some of these companies, what else can they be? Is it enough? Is it not enough? Can we do more? How do we get more companies interested in the programs like yours?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, one thing I don't understand is why companies don't run them themselves. But I'm quite happy if they want to pay us to run them.
That's right.
Because I guess we're the educators, right? So maybe that is the best way to do it. But I think, I mean, it just surprises me that companies will still pay a recruiter, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000 dollars to recruit someone. But it costs less than that to train them specifically into the job roles that they want. So
yeah. I see it all the day.
I just find that quite weird that no one kind of just there's not an
at least here that. My experience here is there's not an emphasis on training and learning and development. There's an assumption that you went to university and you got some skills and you should be able to apply them like magically, like all of a sudden that should make sense to you, right? And most of the jobs that people do, unless you're a trained doctor or dentist or a specific
traditional
thing,
career,
you're not trained to do the other stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, you know, like degree courses, for example, it's quite hard to keep everything up to date with exactly what industry wants all the time. Right. And a lot of the time, you know, you've got to have those theoretical underpinnings, which probably some of it, you know, even in tech goes back, you know, like some of it 50 years or 100 years of stuff you need to learn about from like logic or, you know, goes back thousands of years, right? So all of that needs to be in there kind of underpinning. And then you know, I feel like it's best if you get further towards the what's happening in industry towards the end of your degree. But you start with the theoretical underpinnings, and that's just kind of how our, I guess, degree systems work. But it's just reminding me that I teach our first year students, and the teaching that I do is to bring people in from industry to talk to our students about all the different kinds of jobs that are out there in tech. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when I joined Durham, I realized from talking to quite a few students that they really, most people thought they had to be a programmer or, you know, like, writing code, basically. And of course, that's a great career and a great job role. But there are so many different types of jobs in tech now. I mean, just you can't count them because there's so many. And I really wanted to help their first years to understand that there's all of these opportunities out there.
Right.
And actually what I've done in terms of the coursework that I've given all the first years is they, so we've run these panels throughout the term, and then they need to talk about what they've enjoyed about listening to our industry speakers, but then what do they think they're going to do in their career now? Mm-hmm. And so they've all recorded 2-minute selfie videos, which I'm marking at the moment. I've got 245 students.
That's a lot.
So it's taken me quite a long time, but it's interesting to hear what they say. And lots of them want to go into AI, machine learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's kind of like a really big topic.
Hot topic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
or
VR.
Or fintech.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. That is, I was interviewing some younger folks, and they all said the same thing, which I think is phenomenal, right? And like the possibilities and the use cases that one can imagine are truly endless, right? But what is going to make a profit is what those organizations are going to want to hear about. They don't want to hear about all the other stuff, right? So how to make them money at the end of the day. What would some advice you'd be giving to folks as they're evaluating where and what they should be doing and how should they think about their careers?
Well, so in technology, well, I think if you're coming into tech as a career these days, like we're saying, there's so many different jobs available. So I would start by thinking about, well, what do you love doing, which is not tech? And then what job roles are there in tech which relate to that? Because I feel like it won't be long before every career involves technology, you know, to a reasonable degree. So what you want to be doing is something that you're very passionate about, and then kind of connecting that with technology in some way.
So making that intersection between your passions and whatever can be created that way.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Awesome. So what are you working on today? What are some, what's next? You've been traveling, you've been doing talks. Like, so what does this look like now for you?
Well, more traveling.
Nice.
Conferences. I mean, I'm always giving talks all over the place. So I've just given talks in Sydney in Australia and Singapore, and now coming here is really cool. And I'll be in Austin for South by Southwest in a couple of weeks' time. So yeah, traveling around and kind of spreading the word. And then at the same time, you know, I'm really interested in stuff actually that's been in the news recently, you know, like ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my PhD students has been working in that area for a couple of years now, looking at GPT-3, which ChatGPT is built upon, and looking at bias in AI. So it's interesting because AI is not my main research area. It was like software engineering, software metrics, software quality. But I've got more and more interested in AI over the years, as I think as everyone, because it's become more and more powerful, because we've got more computing power now. So AI is, you know, really become a real thing that we can use, not like it was when I studied it at university, where it seemed like a pipe dream back then. So that's interesting. And so one of my colleagues at work told me, and my PhD student Sarah, about GPT-3 and like large scale language models and what they could do. And we got very excited about that and so thought, well, let's play around with it and see if we can find any bias, was our first thought. So we just kind of like went away, played around for maybe 10 seconds, and already
you found it.
We honestly thought it might take a week or something. And you know, so you can, I don't know, people that have used ChatGPT, you know, you put prompts in and you get a response basically. So what we decided to do was to type in men can and get some responses, women can get some responses, black women can and get some responses. And it was as horrific as you can probably imagine. And even like with men can, so much violent stuff came back. with women can, violent stuff, sexualized stuff, misogynist stuff. Black women can, you know, add on the racism and all sorts of stuff. So that was, we probably first did that maybe 18 months ago. I'm not sure exactly about the timescales. And so what Sarah's done is has taken kind of snapshots of 10,000 responses several times over a time period and is comparing the several snapshots with each other to see what are OpenAI doing about this issue, because obviously mm-hmm. that is an issue. And what she's found is that they're masking. So they're masking the output. So rather than getting all this awful stuff back, most of it just comes back as a blank, like there's just nothing there. And so, I don't know, bias in AI, I think we could talk about that for a long ages. Time.
And I know that there's chief women that I've talked with around, this is a hot topic around clinical trials. And because randomizing and using AI in order to get better diversity on clinical trials,
right.
and as we get more refined medicines, it's a big deal. And if, and a lot of folks are moving towards this, but if we have a bias problem to start, we're not going to get the actual data that we need. So it's a very, very hot topic. And I don't know. It's I need to educate myself as we get along here, because it's I think.
Well, and it's going to affect more and more people in more and more ways. So, you know, it's something to really, I think, you know, what we need is to help everyone understand as much as possible what's going on in a kind of basic way, so that when things do look like it's the wrong decision or the wrong output in something, then we question it as regular members of the public,
right.
So that all these decisions don't get made and people just think, well, I just have to go along with this because that's what the computer told me of thing.
Well, it's also human nature too, right? Whether or not to question stuff. Or being tolerant of the conversation, right? The hard conversations in order to get to the nuggets in there is very uncomfortable for folks. What do we think some practical like strategies in order to get our organizations and individuals start looking at truly impacting the diversity, equity, inclusion problems that we have? I mean, I part of the conversations I've been having is and I'm kind of done with the checkbox list, right? Organizations having, you're going to watch this 4-minute video and you're going to sign that you've done this. Like, but how do we get to the real, real transformative stuff? Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I'm not an expert in this area. So I just kind of like doing my best, trying to work out what is the best thing to do for everybody. But I think from talking to quite a few people, I think it comes from the top. So within an organization, the person at the top that everyone kind of looks to needs to be talking about this stuff regularly and showing that they really do care about the culture in the workplace, about inclusivity, about everyone feeling included in the workplace. And if it doesn't come from the top, it's not going to work. So, I mean, that is a really simple thing, but I think it's very powerful, and I think that has to be in an authentic way as well. Mm-hmm. So kind of like authentic, inclusive leadership, I would say, is the most important thing.
Yeah. I was hopeful after, you know, we came out of COVID, that a lot of the positive lessons learned from COVID would last. I'm not seeing that in a practical day-to-day life. Do you have any reflections of coming out of COVID or
I think some things, so, you know, like working in tech, it's reasonably normal before lockdown, before COVID, to do Zoom chats or Teams chats, mm-hmm. whatever. Well, now everyone knows what they are mm-hmm. and likes them to a greater or lesser degree. But I think that's helped get just lots of workforces, I guess, just a bit more tech savvy around what mm-hmm. we can do. And also, I think, you know, those people that said everyone's got to be in the office from 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or whatever, well, they don't, do they? Because we now know that most things kept running without people being in the office from 9 to 5. So I think there are those learnings. And I think some companies are still, you know, are going to go along with hybrid working. And so people don't need to be in the office mm-hmm. 5 days a week. Right. So I think from a sort of inclusion point of view, I think that's valuable.
Do you have any thoughts about what we can do in tech to make that hybrid experience more tangible or more effective?
Comfortable.
Like, so, I mean, I do presentations too, and a lot of the presentations today are also hybrid,
yeah.
right? So I'm navigating physical people and also people online. It's very hard as a presenter to be able to do the room, right? Like, that's not, it's not a natural skill for me, that's for sure. And it's, and the technology surely has not caught up.
No, I don't actually know what we do about that. But I think, I mean, I guess we're moving towards it because so many more people are now used to accessing things online, so talks online. So yeah, in terms of the technology, I'm not sure. But I think in terms of people being used to that and comfortable with it, I think we've moved along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as we move towards a more perfect, but it's not perfect, just a more ideal in our minds, right? The more inclusive, equitable way of being. Where do you think we're going to stumble? Is there something that we need to struggle with as a community to take this to the next level?
I think one of the things that's hard is talking about the things that you don't understand or feel uncomfortable with, or, you know, like, particularly when we're talking about groups in society that have had a very difficult time for various reasons. And, you know, I think those things are still quite hard for lots of us to talk about. So, you know, as a now middle-class white woman, I can't know exactly what it's like to be a black woman. I mean, I just can't know that, right? And so, you know, I think we all need to try and have conversations to help all of us understand what it's like from other people's experience and perspective, and to not rush in to comment on it, just to listen and try to understand as much as possible. And I don't always see that happening. I mean, particularly if you look on social media, my goodness, mm-hmm. you know, like, no one can say anything without someone jumping in to right. attack them, you know. And I've seen friends in the UK who, you know, have had horrific times, you know, death threats, and they're not saying anything to me that's radical at all. It's kind of common right. sense and what should happen. So for them to get death threats and all sorts of abuse is horrific. And I think that, you know, that's the extreme end, but that's where we really need to work on trying to normalize having difficult conversations and just letting people speak about their experience and not judging them.
Yeah. Easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's definitely something that I know I've been trying to cultivate with my kid, and I see your kid doing doing the same. Like, that's hopeful for me to see the next generation being so much more present, so much more non-judgmental, so much more in their bones to be who they want to be, which is something that I wasn't able to do.
No, am I there yet? I think I'm there now. I'm 60 I'm close. Now. Yeah,
I'm close, but I'm not quite all there. But yeah. So having that more free dialogue at a younger age to be able to do that. So that is truly hopeful. So I'm curious, as we start wrapping up here, like, what is the, you know, as you move in, you're still a professor, you're doing that less and less, right? You're doing more speaking. What's next for you? Maybe something else, how do you want to do the next 10?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I guess, I mean, I want to, as I get older, I get more and more confident. and I more and more want to impact more and more people, you know, in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So I particularly care about women and people from underserved communities, but in general, I care about everybody. And I guess I want to have more impact. And so, I mean, potentially thinking about my academic career, I mean, my goal was for a long time to be vice chancellor of a university. So that's still something that I'm kind of thinking about and possibly heading towards. You know, I think I could be a good vice chancellor. So that could be on the cards. But I think anything that really makes a big impact in the areas that I care about would, you know, would make me happy.
Yeah. So being true to you and then bringing that inspiring others. So that sounds awesome.
Thank you.
Well, is there anything else that we want to touch on while we have this opportunity?
Can't think of anything.
Here? Do you guys have any questions, thoughts, comments?
Yeah.
Cool. Did you? And this is from my husband.
So this is fed from my husband as well. Did you always know you liked math?
Yeah, I guess so, because I liked it when I was five. I can remember my memories of my first couple of years at school are I loved doing math. So, yeah, I guess so.
Because you always tell the story. Yeah. And you say, and I went into math, and even that is an unusual choice for most women, let's be honest. So I thought it must be something that you always enjoyed.
Yeah, so. I think I did. I mean, so at home we did like puzzles and mazes and quizzes, and I always absolutely loved all of that. And math just seemed like an extension of that, really, at school. So, yeah.
There you go. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
No. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up here. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no.
It was wonderful to see you.
Thank you, cousin.
Yes. And we're going to wrap up and maybe we'll do it again. We'll do it across the pond. Maybe I come over.
Sounds cool.
We'll do it all. All right. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today. If you like what you just heard, we hope you pass along our web address, procellarx.co, to your friends and colleagues, and please leave us a positive review on iTunes. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts and check us out on LinkedIn at ProcellarX. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.